The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
With great mojo comes great responsibility. Mojo 5-0. Mojo 5-0.
We will make America great again.
Sam Sorbo.
Hi, welcome to the Sam Sorbo Show. I'm joined by a favorite guest of mine, Larry Taunton. He's the executive director of the Fixed Point Foundation. He's also a freelance columnist. He has a few pieces out on the Daily Wire, most recently regarding the situation in Ukraine. He's the author of The Grace Effect, the Gospel Coalition Book of the Year, The Faith of Christopher Hitchens, and the just released book Around the World in More Than 80 Days. But he's been to Russia and to Ukraine many times, and he and his wife adopted a daughter from a Ukrainian orphanage. And so Larry reached out to me to talk about the situation in the Ukrainian orphanages and how Russia is behaving, particularly because he's quite incensed at the way that we are approaching Ukrainian orphanages. So Larry, welcome to the show.
How are you, Sam?
Yeah. It's good to see you, and I really wanted to give you a platform to explain this because there's this narrative out right now that it's poor Ukraine and bad, evil Russia. And I've seen this now a couple times in different places on the internet, and I've been part of it, I have to say. This idea that, listen, you've lied to me for 2 years about a pandemic that there's no pandemic in Florida. Okay. I live here. There's no real pandemic here. So we've been lied to for 2 years. Now they're telling us, hey, focus all your attention on Ukraine. And I feel like it's kind of a shell game with the American public, with the world public, basically. And you specifically pointed out these orphanages that are supposedly under attack, right? So let's just start there and you can walk us through that. But I do want to sort of touch on the idea. You've got a lot of history. I mean, you studied Russian history and Russian literature. And so I want to talk about this ongoing conflict between Ukraine and Russia and the relationship there and what we might just be missing with the reports that we're getting over here.
Thank you, Sam. It's always a pleasure to be with you. Well, first of all, let's state out of the gate what you and I believe, what I think every sensible conservative believes, and that is our genuine sympathies are with the common Ukrainian people, you know, who are suffering terribly in this war. However, anytime you try to push back, however mildly, at the idea that all things Ukrainian are great and wonderful, and that Ukraine is a beacon of freedom and democracy, and that all things Russian are necessarily evil, you're immediately lambasted. You're called a Putin supporter, a Nazi, a fascist, you know, whatever. These kinds of things immediately come out. And it's been interesting for me, Sam, because I've been watching a guy on Twitter, a former congressman by the name of Joe Walsh, not, by the way, to be confused with the Eagles guitarist named Joe Walsh. This guy doesn't have anywhere near that level of talent, but he's just a guy who's just throwing red meat out there to progressives or to people who are his followers. And interestingly enough, I was engaging him on Twitter about some of these things. He's just simply asking him, what do you know about Ukraine? Have you ever been to Russia? You ever been to Ukraine? Do you know anything about what you're talking about? And in fact, he was claiming a couple of days ago on Twitter. And again, I mean, this is a guy who probably has a, you know, 500,000 followers, you know, or something, who's claiming that millions, quote, millions of Ukrainians were dying in this war. And I was just kind of like, Joe, I mean, do you realize that, you know, 9 million people died in World War One, roughly 55 million people died in World War Two, but you're already claiming that within a month, we have millions of Ukrainian casualties. And the guy has to know that he's lying and he's trying to manipulate, anybody who would read him on Twitter. Well, this is the kind of thing that's happening in our media in a very big way. Let me be very clear. Ukraine is a horrible country. Russia is a horrible country. And by that, I mean, they're neither of them are democratic. And in fact, democracy and freedom, as it is understood in the West, are both alien to these countries, utterly alien to these countries. And they are both deeply, deeply corrupt political cultures. And what really caught my attention, Sam, was, our daughter, who we adopted in 2009 from a Ukrainian orphanage. I've been in Ukraine many times, no less than seven times. I've been in Russia, near that number. And in order to adopt our daughter, Sasha, we had to bribe every single Ukrainian official we encountered, save one, in order to do what anyone with a modicum of decency would have wanted to do for free. That is to say, get Sasha a home.
And just to clarify,
that's what they did.
Yeah, oftentimes, really what you're bribing them for is for them to sign a paper.
Exactly. Yeah, or to put a stamp on it.
Yeah.
You know, they're all about stamps. You know, almost nothing is digitized. So we're all about these stamps. And
you with our Western sensibility and our charity, you're sitting there going, why wouldn't they just stamp it? Like, what's keeping them from stamping it? And then all of a sudden the light bulb goes off and you're going, oh, they're just waiting for money.
Exactly.
Oh, okay. Well, if that's what it takes, okay, we'll give him the money and then he'll stamp the thing. And it goes beyond, like, we just think that people should behave nicely, but that's not how it works outside of our little bubble of this free society that we've created in the United States. And I think that a lot of people who don't travel, perhaps, or perhaps just haven't been educated, don't understand how special it is that we have this thing that I call we've inherited our morality. We've inherited it and we're spending our inheritance rapidly and we're not replenishing it. In other words, we're not working on morality to reinvigorate, to reinsert it into our communities, into our culture. So we're just spending this moral capital and we are going in the way of Ukraine and Russia and the rest of the world in those terms, because all you needed to do was pay these people off. But that's not the way the world is. That's not the beautiful way that the world can work. They're depriving themselves of something.
You've opened a big can of worms here and an important one. My book, The Grace Effect, which was my first book, is telling the story of Sasha's adoption. But I'm telling the story against the broader background of what socialism is and how Ukraine and Russia are still running off of old Soviet ideas and what that looks like and what a society looks like when you have drained it of a Judeo-Christian worldview. You talk about naive Americans. You're so right. I was speaking to, I'm in Colombia, South America right now. And I was speaking with a woman yesterday who I could just tell by looking at her. She'd just gotten off of a plane from DC. She was very pleasant. She was likable. She was an American. And I said, look, be careful. Everything about you says I'm an American. I've seen you leave your purse on the table a couple of times while you went up to the bar and this kind of thing. This isn't the United States anymore that you're in. You're accustomed to living in a nice neighborhood and where, private property is respected. It's sacred, generally speaking. I mean, unless we're talking about Black Lives Matter or Antifa, it's generally speaking, you know, sacred in the United States. You're not there anymore. And you're making the assumption that everyone here holds your values and they don't. So I want you to be very careful. And she started asking me a few questions and I said, look, I don't want to frighten you, but don't get into the taxis here alone. A woman should never ride in the taxis by herself. And anyway, I see this kind of thing a lot traveling much as I do.
The things that we take for granted, because we have a social contract in the United States that was put in place by our Constitution and our Declaration of Independence, by our founding documents. And that social contract is we respect each other's humanity. We respect them as human beings. We're slowly losing that. But when you travel abroad, you're often struck by the fact that they don't have that to begin with. And then Larry, we think that we can just go over there and flip a switch and install democracy as if they really understand what that is. But democracy is founded on life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And by democracy, of course, I mean representational republic. I try not to conflate those two. But the idea that the individual is sovereign, the individual has a sovereignty and that they have value as a human being, and the way we term it, as a created human being, right? And they don't necessarily have that in other countries. And that's what you're just pointing out to this gal. You're going, you know, just be careful because they don't look at you as a sovereign individual who has value. They look at you potentially just as a pocketbook to rob or something else.
Well, you know, case in point, Zelensky and the Ukrainian media machine, which is substantial and aided by the West, ran this narrative about how Putin was targeting with missile strikes Ukrainian orphanages. Now, first of all, I don't believe that for a second, not because Putin cares anything about orphans, because he doesn't care about Ukrainian orphans or Russian orphans, but it's of no strategic value for him to do that. But to hear the Ukrainian narrative, we love our orphans and look at how they're treated and help us because of what they're doing to our orphans. And I felt enraged because I thought, you're the people that when we entered into that orphanage, we discovered the children are, they're beaten, sexually molested, sometimes, Sam, rented out to perverts, children.
It's called human trafficking. And we ought to acknowledge that Ukraine is a center of human trafficking on the face of the earth.
Big time. And I've already mentioned the bribes, but Sam, you know, at the orphanage where Sasha was, we're only, you know, just a few miles from the coast in Odessa. Deribasovskaya Street, a very exclusive neighborhood, supercars going up and down the road, these yachts that, you know, 10 million wouldn't really even get you a down payment on. And here they were in these orphanages where our Sasha, who is now our daughter, these children were not given toilet paper. I mean, toilet paper. I took pictures of the bathrooms, which are just holes in the ground. And Lori, being a sensible woman like you, when Sasha, during the process of adopting her, she was allowed to come to our apartment some days, and then she had to be returned to the orphanage at night. And she was wearing the same clothes, smelly clothes, dirty clothes every day. Lori takes her out, buys her brand new clothes, you know, nice, one of those soft, you know, what do you call them, those fleece pullovers and, you know, just some comfortable, nice clothing. Well, our adoption facilitator, who's a Ukrainian, said to us, and who knows the adoption process very well, he says, don't let her wear those clothes back to the orphanage. Well, why not? Well, because the directors will steal them and they'll give them to their own children or they'll sell them. So every day she would come. Lori would take Sasha's clothes and put them, you know, launder them. She would put the new clothes on her. She would stay with us all day long. And then towards evening, we would take the new clothes off and put the old clothes back on, which had now been laundered, and send her back to the orphanage. This process was repeated every day. And so now to hear, you know, how much they love their, and no, you're not a country who loves your orphans. You don't care about your orphans. You don't care about them at all. And the Russians don't care about them either. So people need to be paying close attention to the propaganda war as right. much as the war itself.
Right. It is everything now is a propaganda war. And
yes.
the good news, Larry, is we're seeing it more and more. We are internalizing the lesson. We are understanding it more that perception is everything. And so the way that people manipulate your perception of facts is everything. And we're paying closer attention, which is a good thing for sure. And it's a sad thing because it makes us cynical. And so when I hear a story about orphanages, you reach out and I'm like, oh yeah, we're going to talk about that because we have to pay attention. They're playing a game with the messaging. We need to take a quick break. And then I'm going to come back and ask you about more of the history between Russia and Ukraine and maybe get a better picture of sort of what's at play, what's at stake right now. This is the Sam Sorbo Show. I'm talking with Larry Taunton. He's the executive director of the Fixed Point Foundation, and he's written several books, one of which, The Grace Effect, talks about the orphanages over in Ukraine, which is what we spent the first half of this talk discussing. But also he's written a book called The Faith of Christopher Hitchens, which is a favorite of mine. I highly recommend it. It's a fascinating book and a fascinating look at one of the world's most well-known atheists. You humanize him, you personalize him in a way that I think very few people would have had the opportunity to do. You had the opportunity to get to know him very well. But we've been talking about Russia and Ukraine, and you're sort of a Russian expert, I suppose, a Russian historian. So I want to get a better sense of kind of the macro vision of what this is. Now, I've heard other Russian experts, and I always put expert now in quotes, in air quotes.
As well, you should.
Talking about how Putin just wants to basically reconstitute the Soviet Union or the glory days of the Russian Empire. And in that way, he feels entitled to Ukraine and he wants Ukraine. And then I've also heard, I don't know if you saw, Oliver Stone did a little documentary.
I didn't see it, but I've seen it's been banned. Yeah.
And it's fascinating because, okay, there are two takeaways from that. He goes through the whole documentary and he basically positions it as Russia is just serving the needs of the Russian or pro-Russian Ukrainian community by sort of protecting their interests. And Putin's actually not such a bad guy after all, but also that Putin is against the World Economic Forum.
Yeah.
And the other thing that he tries to point out is that the fascists are opposing Putin. And it's fascinating because he thinks the fascists are right wing, but fascism is not right wing. And so he finds himself in very strange territory because he's indicting Republicans who, you know, are quote unquote the fascists, but he's also having to indict Obama and Biden and Pelosi and the leftists as well. And so he's kind of a man with no country right now. He's sort of in a no man's land through this documentary from what I can tell. And I don't know exactly because he does leave it a little bit open-ended, but I know documentary filmmaking and you pick and choose what you want to present. And the way he presents it is the fascists and the leftists are in cahoots, which doesn't surprise me. It surprises him. It doesn't surprise me. To take over the world in a sense. And we shouldn't, I think his position is we have no business in getting involved in that if we're not going to kind of support Russia.
Wow. Yes, there's a lot to unpack there. I can't help but be somewhat amused that Oliver Stone, who is, of course, you know, the poster child for leftism, you know, forever, is, yeah, you know, is now, you know, he's now not radical enough. And so he's booted off of YouTube.
Exactly.
With his film. I mean, you know, there's an old saying, revolutions, you know, eat their children. And this is of course, what's happened in that case.
Well, by the way, the reason that there's a saying that revolutions eat their children, and America is a notable exception to that.
Yes.
The revolution eats its children because the revolution typically comes from the left, and communists eat their children.
Well, you know, in a very big way, the French Revolution, it was true of, I mean, you know, Robespierre was himself sent to the guillotine. So, you know, the old Soviets, the old Bolsheviks, you know, under Lenin and Stalin were eventually executed, you know, en masse, you know, so many of them. And the American Revolution really is, you know, as one well-known historian put it, really wasn't a revolution. It was a civil war. And there's a real difference between those two, because revolutions, by definition, seek to overthrow the past in toto, to annihilate it and create something utterly new in its place. And the American Revolution, as Edmund Burke, you know, the father of modern conservatism, he was a member of Parliament at the time. He said, look, the Americans are just tweaking the existing British form of government. They're not annihilating the past. They're modifying an existing form of government. Their laws, their traditions are ours. The basis of their law is English common law. So, some big differences there. With Ukraine and Russia, this is a very convoluted past. And a way to give you some sense of the complexity of the problem, we know immediately when I tell you that the first Russian state was not founded in modern day Russia. It was founded in the 800s in Kiev. It was called Kievan Rus. And Rus was founded in what is modern day Ukraine. And so the two countries have been kind of welded together on and off throughout their histories. This isn't like, say, Hitler invading Poland. You know, Catherine the Great referred to Ukraine as Little Russia. Peter the Great, who preceded her, you know, believed that Ukraine was vital to Russia's existence. This continued all the way down into our own time. And so when you hear people who are saying, well, you know, if it's all about NATO, why did Putin not invade, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, all border buffer states that became members of NATO? And I say, you need to understand, those countries aren't Ukraine. Even at a basic level of understanding Russian-Ukrainian history, you have to understand that Russia has historically always deemed Ukraine as absolutely vital to its security and to its survival. Words and terms like, breadbasket and warm water port, you know, appear all the time in Russia's history. Furthermore, you have to understand that some of the key figures in Russian history were themselves Ukrainians. Leon Trotsky was a Ukrainian. Leonid Brezhnev was a Ukrainian. He would have deemed what's happening now among the Ukrainians as treasonous. Nikita Khrushchev.
In what way? Sorry, explain that. What's treasonous about what's happening among the Ukrainians?
Well, because he believed in the Soviet Union. He believed that Ukraine should belong to the Soviet empire.
So the fact that Ukraine established independence from Russia was the big mistake.
Would be seen. In other words, there are plenty of Ukrainians who would take the view. At last poll, I think it was 16%. Of Ukrainians want to rejoin, you know, the old Soviet Union. So, you know, there's a lot of Russia speakers in Ukraine. ethnic Russians. This is highly problematic. It's like trying to, and this maybe this even doesn't really work, but it's something more like trying to disentangle England and Wales or England and Scotland. It's a much harder thing. And also given the fact that their political cultures that they share are very similar, they're both corrupt, and they're both mafia-like governments.
Now, and don't forget that Ukraine was targeted by Stalin and starved.
Absolutely. And the what happened in 1932. This was a state-engineered famine. More than a million died. I've published a piece about that as well called A Famine of Truth. Interestingly enough, to show you how the Potemkin village and propaganda works, Stalin invited George Bernard Shaw in 1931. He invited him to come to Russia and see how great it was. George Bernard Shaw, the only man to be given both an Academy Award and a Nobel Prize for Literature. In my opinion, he didn't deserve either. He was a hardcore communist, but he was invited to Russia to see what was going on. And he came back declaring it, oh, this is the nearest to what society would look like if Jesus came down and created a society.
Well, you mentioned Potemkin Village. So just explain briefly what that is.
My apologies. Potemkin Village, the Russians are very, very good at this. Ukrainians, too. It's where we say, Sam Sorbo, we want you to come and see. You know, Larry has alleged that the orphanages are terrible. Come and see the orphanages. And so what they do is they take you to an orphanage where they've given that they've moved the children into new facilities. They've bathed them all, give them all new clothing, fattened them up a bit with some food, and then they march you through it. And you say, well, Larry clearly is a liar. Look at this. This is a model of what an orphanage should be. And the moment you leave, the clothes are taken from the children. The children are loaded up on a truck and sent back to where they came from. It's a Hollywood set. It's a fake.
Yeah,
this is a Potemkin village. Well, interestingly enough, another man went to Russia at the same time in the 1930s who was also a communist. And that man's name was Malcolm Muggeridge. But Muggeridge kept hearing rumors of a famine in Ukraine. And so he managed to escape from his KGB handlers who always made sure he stayed within the Potemkin village. And he went to Ukraine where he saw the famine, where he saw that millions were dying, where he saw cannibalism. And he began writing about it. And just as a side note, Muggeridge became a Christian as a result of that experience. But Muggeridge was condemned as a liar. You know, Western newspapers didn't want to publish what he was saying because they're saying you're making all this up. And a writer for guess whom? The New York Times, a man by the name of Walter Duranty, who was carrying the propaganda water for Stalin, was given a Pulitzer Prize that to this day has not been revoked.
Right. And by the way, just to put a bow on some of this, to add injury to insult, to add insult to injury. The thing that really got me about the famine in Ukraine is they posted signs, please don't eat your children. Mm. And the Ukrainian famine was designed by Stalin. It was perpetrated against the Ukrainian people. And so for that reason, I don't have very much sympathy for Russia coming into Ukraine, but I also don't have very much sympathy for Zelensky and for them trying to position Ukraine as this terrible, as this poor victim, because I know how much corruption is over there. There's a reason that our politicians' offspring are heavily, deeply involved in Ukraine. There is a reason for that. It's because of the corruption that's over there.
Are you bringing up Hunter Biden?
I wasn't mentioning him by name, but I can because it's very clear But it's not just Biden. It's Romney. It's I believe it's Pelosi. I can't remember. I saw a list recently. So it's a lot. There's a lot of stuff in Ukraine. And so there is a lot of and by the way, we send a lot of money to Ukraine. That's why there's so much corruption. If you fund it, it will get bigger.
Yeah, so, with American money. You know, we were just talking about revolutions leading their
own. Our time is yep. running out. I'm so sorry, but we're going to have to end it there. Okay, so where can people find you?
Find me at Larry Alex Taunton, TAUNTON, LarryAlexTaunton.com. It's been great to be with you, Sam.
Thanks for coming on the show. This is the Sam Sorbo Show. I'm joined now by Abigail Martinez. She's a California mother who recently lost her daughter to the transgender movement. I say that because her daughter was in school, was basically coerced by a transgender club, was it highly influenced by the individuals in the club to declare herself to be a boy, to then transition into being a man. And eventually she took her own life. And this California mom is speaking out. I think it's been about 2.5 years since her daughter committed suicide. And she finally said, I can't be silent anymore. People need to know this story. And she's hoping that by telling her story, she will enlighten some other parents. She feels that I'll let her put it in her own words. Abigail Martinez, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
So, yes. Sorry. So your daughter began transitioning basically soon after she started high school, correct?
That is correct.
Yeah. And they have transgender sort of clubs on campuses across the United States now, but certainly in your daughter's high school. But she didn't tell you about it, did she?
No.
So go ahead.
Yeah, she didn't tell me that she was going and meeting with these other kids. I find out through my other daughter.
Yeah. How many other children do you have?
Four. Three girls and a boy.
You have four children. So are they older or younger than Abigail was?
Than Yaeli.
Yaeli.
Yaeli is the middle one, and my youngest son, who is 19 at the moment. So, he's the youngest. She's the middle one. And I have the oldest. The two middle ones, sisters, they are 17 months apart. So they were a year apart in high school.
Gotcha. So talk to me about what precipitated her declaring herself to be transitioning.
Well, there was a lot of facts. The school, the CPS, because CPS got involved, LGBT. And the club that she was, at the school where she was meeting, she met another.
But let's walk back just a bit before then, because she had just started high school. Is that right?
Yes, it was like the middle of freshman year when she started to, changing and, acting. She was going in through depression after she turned 13.
When she turned 13, she started having sort of bouts of depression or just being depressed.
Yes.
And 13, so she started high school when she was how old?
She was 14. She's an April girl. So, okay. Yes.
So after the depression, she started going to high school. High school is arguably a difficult transition for young people. There's a lot of anxiety associated with going to high school. Did you notice any of that for her as well?
Yes, she was very, anxious. It's the school that they went to is a pretty big school. think they have like over 4,000 kids.
Wow.
So it's a big school. So for them, you know, coming from small school, private school, and then going to a public school, I think it was a big change.
And when did you notice any kind of shift in her after she started attending high school? Like,
yeah,
that was sort of more immediate, because the club came a little bit further in, right?
Yes, it was. She was going into social media, and she started, you know, talking with these kids who have, you know, they talk about, you know, how depressed they are, cutting themselves, and apparently she was helping them not to do it. When
she had started in social media as kind of a counseling kids, trying to help them.
Yes. And she did. And she did. She did help a lot of kids. But I, you know, I suggest her not to do it because she was so young to, you know, to hold all these kids' problem. So you can suggest to go to a counselor. But you're not prepared for that. And you say, Mom, you know that I that's my thing, helping others. And yes, but you're young. Your brain is not prepared for that. So my kid, when they turn 13, they all get a cell phone so they can communicate. Anything happen, they can call me. She couldn't keep her cell phone for that long. I took it away because she was, I saw that she was, you know, just on the phone, just talking to these people, looking how they cut themselves. And I thought it was not a good idea. I thought it was not healthy for her. She was so young and she had a big heart. And of course it was going to affect her. So I did, but she managed how to still get in line, you know, and the computer. So no matter what I did, she was determined to help others. And then she started to cut herself.
And then she started to cut herself?
Yes. Yes. Her arms. Yes.
And did you know that?
She was
at the time?
At the beginning, she was hiding it. You know, she always, it was hard. And she said, Jaylee, it's going to be hard today. Oh, no, I'm comfortable with sweaters. So until I saw her and I said, what's going on? And that's when I started, you know, seeking for help.
Okay, so what did you do then? So that's between freshman and sophomore?
It was middle school, yeah.
Oh, it was still in middle school that she started to cut herself?
She started to cut herself, yes.
Wow. Yeah.
It was middle
school. So young.
Very, very young.
And she found support for that behavior online, I'm sure.
Oh, yes. And I think she felt like, I told her, you know, if you're talking with all these kids that are going through this, you know, depression and cutting themselves or trying to find a way how to, that's not healthy. You can't be talking. And yes, sure enough, she started to cut herself. First, you know, she was helping them.
Did you feel at that point, did you feel like you were losing communication with her or losing losing a tether?
Oh, yes. Yes. Because she was like, oh, I'm not going to let my mom see what's going on. And when I took her phone away, it was like she got like, oh, no. And she found her way. She bought an iPod through a friend in school with her own money.
Wow. So at that point, you must have felt somewhat helpless.
Yes, I did.
You tried to get her counseling, and then she went to high school.
Yes, before she started going to high school, I talked to the schools, you know, I thought they will help so to keep an eye on her. And then I seek for help outside. going to counseling. She was going, but once she was trying to overdose, that's when CPS came into the house. And that's when they took control of it.
They took control. And the counselor who had been talking to her, do you still respect the counselor that you found? Do you respect their efforts before she tried to commit suicide the first time?
No, because I find out that they were, you know, they find out because they told you, no, only if they've been abused at home, they're going to report, but other what they talk, they're not going to communicate to us. It's like they keep it like between.
Right.
Them.
So the counselor was keeping things from you. And yes. Now you suspect that the counselor was actually not helpful to the daughter at all?
Not helpful. No, she was supporting because my daughter after, you know, when she went into high school is when she starting to, you know, see these other people and talking about, you know, the more I talk, I find out that they learned a lot in these groups like, you're in the wrong body. That's what happened. That's why you're depressed. Do you feel like you're a boy? And of course, you know, at this age, they, maybe, huh? So that's how everything started. So I didn't, the counselor that I found, she was like supporting, yes, you allow your entire, and I went to counselor with her too. So she was like, you know, you should let your daughter be herself and express how she feels. And then that's when I got like, okay, where are we going here? So she was telling me that she wants to have, a haircut because she used to have long hair. So let her, you know, just express how she feels. That's, you know, healthy. That's normal. And I said, yeah, but where are we going to get with this? Yes, I allow her to do this and that. And, you know, I think this is deeper than what she feel like she needs in the outside. Changing looks and that's not going to help.
So, and yet at the same time, they're saying to you, my gosh, it's just a haircut. Just let her get her haircut. Like, what's the big deal?
Yes,
but at the same time,
let her dye her hair. And I did. And I said, and I promise you that it's not going to work. Sure enough, she was not happy. She was not happy with the she dyed her hair. And I was like the mom that, she doesn't want to. No, it was not that. I was more focusing on her mental illness than clothes or look or no. I knew that something, you know, was bothering her.
Right.
And I want them to help me find out what it was.
I'm talking with Abigail Martinez. She's the mother of a young woman who was transgendering, so-called transgendering, and eventually ended up committing suicide. The mother has now decided to come forward and speak about this. She did a press conference at the Heritage Center, the Heritage Foundation, which was stunning. And it's a tragic story. And I'm so glad, Abigail, that you've decided to tell your story so that other parents might be able to figure out how to navigate these waters. You discovered, in a sense, after the fact, that the counselor you hired to help your daughter manage the change. And basically, you know, I think a lot of this stems from just the change, just the puberty and going through changes. Your body's changing. You're uncomfortable. Young women typically have a very big sense of insecurity. And a sense of not belonging, and they want to belong. And so she was, in a sense, she was seduced by the transgender community in her school, the club, But you feel that you were absolutely betrayed by the people who we, our tax dollars, pay to care for children. Is that right? Yeah,
that is correct. That is correct, because I feel that they need to communicate with the parents what's going on with your child.
And they've gotten to the point now where they feel they don't have to communicate because the parents are not important. They're important.
That's how they see it. But that's not how it is. We are important in their life. We are the parents. Yes, they go to school there, and I feel like it's like, you know, the second home where you think that they're going to be safe there. Right? They're getting prepared for life, and but you never expect, I never expect this ever, ever. And
so CPS came in basically right after your daughter tried to commit suicide by popping pills.
Yes.
And how did they, because I know that eventually they maneuvered her out of your home. So how did that all come about?
Well, it happened with a peer at school, you know, another older transient girl. She was going into the transition of changing name, and she was older than my daughter.
Right. But so we identified she was, in a sense, the seducer. But how did CPS, they got involved because your daughter committed suicide, but then there was a court hearing.
Yes.
So how soon after the first suicide attempt did they take her out of your home?
Oh, she stayed with me for a while. You know, she ended the school year, the freshman year. It was by summertime, just close to going into 10th grade. That's when this parent with her daughter came to my house and kidnapped my daughter, because I didn't give her permission to go with them. That's how they, you know, even the police, I want to make a report against them. They said, no, we can't do anything. Your daughter wants, you know. Yeah, but she's a minor. And she didn't have my permission. They kept my daughter for 2 days, and we were looking and searching. And that's how everything started. This family was coaching outside the school to my daughter what to do, what to say, so she can stay out of the house. Because I was I've been the bad mom who didn't support that and didn't accept my daughter.
So there was a transgender girl in the high school whose mother and she came, picked up your daughter, and then had her for 2 days and basically coached her on how to behave and what to say.
Yes. And they, what they did, because the police and everyone, I was with friends, you know, posting flyers at the stores everywhere. I went through a lot with that. And they knew that we were looking for them, and they never, you know, had the heart to say, oh, this mother is going nuts with, you know, and we have her. No, I called, you know, several friends, you know, from this other girl. So they all denied, oh, let me see, let me check, and nothing happened. So they didn't call back. When they didn't call me back, I thought they had my daughter. So I report that to the police to check, you know, and they said, well, we're going to wait. So they dropped her off. I can't remember for sure. It was.
Did you use the word kidnapping?
Yes, I did, because that's how.
And the police refused. Why did the police refuse to, basically, they refused to get involved?
Yes, they did. They refused to get involved. That, I don't know, maybe they have friends at the police station, Arcadia Police Station. They have
Let's fast forward just a bit. I don't want to run out of time. There was a court case. There was a court hearing for basically for custody of your daughter, and you tried to get representation.
Yes,
I did. And how did that go?
Didn't work. Nobody. When I told them, you know, LGBT is involved. I told the story.
Yeah.
Right. And I said, this is, and I need help. I need my daughter back. And I was referred to you so you can help me bring my daughter back because this is unfair. I don't want her to, you know, go to this group home where she was placed. And they, they hear, you know, the whole story was okay. But when they hear LGBT, it's like, oh, no, I'm sorry. But you can call this other attorney. They might be able to help you. So I ended getting one of the state.
Public servant.
Public, yes.
And you're reaching out now to the school to try to, are you engaging in a lawsuit right now?
Yes.
To do what?
I just, you know, my focus is in the school, the public school changed, you know, this deal that they have that, oh, this kid is depressed because they might feel like it's not happy with this body and maybe, no, they have to communicate with us what's going on with your child.
So you're fighting for parental rights is really what you're doing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
But you were ousted and then you were told you weren't allowed to mention God.
Oh, yes. When she was moved to this group home, you know, it was court, it was LGBT, everybody involved. And my conversation with her was not, it didn't have to be about coming back home. I was not allowed to talk to my daughter about God.
Who said you weren't? Who told you what you were and were not allowed to speak about?
The social worker. Yes.
Is your lawsuit against the social worker also for effectively limiting your right to free speech?
Yes, and for not. You know, because my work didn't matter when I told them, you know, since day one that when she moved to this group home, we had a meeting and I told them, you know, nothing that you're trying to do is going to work. You can allow her to change everything in her body outside. But the problem is here and that's where I'm seeking for help, you know. I want my daughter to get the right treatment because none of what you're talking, it makes sense because I know that it's not going to work. And if you're fighting here and trying my daughter to start getting these hormones, and it's not going to work.
Here's what's stunning to me. We have a couple more minutes. What's stunning to me and what really ought to set parents completely on edge is the idea that your child was taken from you, which means that you were seen as being abusive because you didn't affirm the lie.
That's
so
right.
So you're seen as being abusive, but they're not. When they're applying medical choices to a child for whom they really have no right to impose their will on. It is such an egregious trampling of not just parental rights, but human rights. They limited your freedom of speech and they basically accused you of being an abuser. And I hope that you're suing them and I hope you're suing for a lot of money. And the reason I say that is because if it doesn't come with punitive damages, this will continue happening in our schools and in our culture. And we have to stop it. We have to stop it because it's costing young people their lives. One last question. I hesitate to ask this, but I have to know. Do you know what happened to the other transgender child? It's been 2.5 years.
She's still around. As a matter of fact, I was hurt because they showed up at the funeral. I didn't want to see any of them around because they had a lot to do with all these two.
Yeah, there's a lot of blame to go around.
The sadly thing is, it's so sad to know that, you know, they pushed my daughter to get the hormone shot, which make, you know, her depression even getting worse. So, and she didn't. The other girl. So, and one more.
Oh, and she didn't. The other girl didn't get it.
No, she didn't.
That's also. It is diabolical. Abigail Martinez, I really appreciate you coming on. Please keep us posted on your progress. I would love to cover the progress of your lawsuit and find out where it goes from there. So thanks for coming on. This is the Sam Sorbo Show.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.